Welcome to episode 5 of Cabin 11, where there is always room for anyone looking for a family. I'm Celeste.
I'm Minnie. And this is Cabin 11, a Percy Jackson podcast.
I guess I'm just going to apologize out front. My cat has been an absolute terror today. So if you hear any weird noises, that's Timon. So I'm just going to jump into this, and this is going to be the fourth time trying to record this section.
Yep.
So we're going to jump right in with our character slash creature spotlight, and this week we are talking about Chiron. So Chiron in Greek mythology is a centaur. He is the son of the titan Cronos and Philyra, and Philyra was a sea nymph. So Chiron lived at the foot of Mount Pelion in Thessaly, but unlike any of the other centaurs who were known to be violent, savage, and just in general very animalistic to their true nature, he was known for having knowledge of medicine and just in general being wise. So for centaurs, if you're not familiar, they are a creature that is the torso of a man or woman and the actual body of a horse. But for Chiron, in traditional Greek representations, he is represented as basically being a human man with a horse attached to him, basically. So his front two legs are human and the back are not.
with a horse attached to him.
You ever seen those costumes where it's two people of the horse? That's Chiron.
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's like someone's just walking around with the back end of the like horse costume just following a regular guy.
Yes.
Oh, amazing.
But in this chapter, I think it's this chapter.
I might be getting ahead of myself. Right,
okay.
At the end, yeah.
We learn that a Chiron, Mr. Brunner, hides his body in a wheelchair. So he has fake human legs, and when he gets up, they describe him as he just kept going.
Yeah. I think it's super interesting that Chiron in this story does differ in that regard. Like, because they could have kept him with regular human legs, not fake ones, given
honestly,
the wheelchair situation.
I think it just made it easier to describe.
Picture, probably.
Yeah, that too.
Also, yeah, like, as a kid, you're not going to understand, like, a human man with, like, a horse.
No, it still doesn't make sense in my brain.
You know? As you'll learn, if you don't already know, Greek mythology is super intertwined, and there's lots of different versions of each story. We've just done some very surface-level research. We're not experts or qualified. Just here to have a good time and dive into a story we love.
Just want to give you some fun information.
Yeah, exactly. You can find Cabin 11 on Instagram at Cabin 11 Podcast and on Twitter at Cabin Percy. Follow these accounts to receive the most up-to-date information about your favorite Percy Jackson podcast. Now, before we splash in, this is the moment where we say that there will be major spoilers ahead. So, first-time readers, proceed with caution. You have been warned. Major spoilers ahead, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, last week, Percy arrived at Camp Half-Blood after quite the ordeal and a fearsome battle with the Minotaur of legend. His mum is missing, and all he has left is the horn of the beast he used to slay it with. Some questions were answered, and a lot more were raised, and we left off with Percy passed out on the doorstep.
Percy has been passed out for 2 whole days, and he wakes up on and off, and each time he meets a new person. The first one is Annabeth, who we were introduced to towards the end of the last chapter. She is absolutely smart enough to catch on to the fact that something isn't right in Olympus, because she keeps asking him these questions, like, what's going to happen at the summer solstice? What was taken? And before he can even try to respond to anything, she just fills his mouth with this pudding substance, which we find out later is, I think it's the nectar of the gods.
Ambrosia?
If I'm recalling it might be the ambrosia. I know that at one point the ambrosia is described as being like little squares, but maybe it's something that they can just make into different things. It wouldn't surprise me. And then the second one is Argus. Argus is Camp Half-Blood's security guard, and we're going to talk about Argus a little bit more at the end, but he is what's called a 100-eyed giant.
Now, the thing I loved about this, like, first, like, paragraph, right, is Annabeth, girl, does not miss an opportunity at all. She's like, this dude's passed out, and she's straight up interrogating him while he's delirious and, like, in and out of consciousness. like, oh, Miss Girl, let the men rest.
This is me when I get home from a close and I see Nick's eyes open for 0.2 seconds. And I'm like, hi, how was your day?
Oh, my God. Yeah, tell me about your life.
And he's like, I'm just trying to sleep.
You're not awake. Go away.
No wake. Once Percy finally wakes up and he is actually, like, conscious, we finally see Grover, and Grover's described as looking like he hasn't slept in weeks. And honestly, I have a very good feeling that Grover probably hasn't slept since they got there. They just went through this huge traumatic event together, and Grover was supposed to be the one protecting him because he's a protector, which we find out more throughout this book. And it just breaks my heart because Grover's just trying so hard to do his best. And if Percy hadn't made it, that would have been the second very good friend of his who didn't make it to Camp Half-Blood.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, Grover had his time being passed out too, though. Like, he was making useless for the whole chapter last time.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, so I wouldn't be surprised if it was, like, him, like, actually not sleeping. He's, like, so feeling so guilt-ridden, not sure if Percy's gonna make it, sort of a thing. So, I mean, I wouldn't be able to sleep. So.
No, I wouldn't either.
One thing I really liked about this particular section is, like, when Percy comes around, the way it was described. When I was reading this back again, the way, like, just how it's described is, I can just picture, like, a legitimate little old lady on a rocking chair, just on her cottage deck, enjoying the summer evening. I'm like, just because he, like, comes around and he notices the warm breeze, mm-hmm. and he has a pillow behind his neck and a blanket over his lap. I'm like, maybe it's the blanket over the lap that helps contribute to this, but it conjures a very specific, peaceful image in my
comforting.
Mind, which is a huge contrast to where we left off, like,
absolutely
chaos. But yeah, no, it's a very, like, comforting, like, soft and warm image, but it does make me think of a little old lady just enjoying the summer evening on her balcony.
Yeah, so there's where I used to vacation growing up. There used to be all these big houses that had these wraparound porches, and it would go right up to the water. And this exactly, it just reminds me of being in Bar Harbor, Maine. I can immediately picture this. There's the wraparound porch. You can see the view. It's grassy and fieldy, but then you've got the ocean out back. So this is beautifully described. And the part that absolutely, like, heart-wrenching for me is that Percy even specifically says that the area is much nicer than he's used to. For a moment, it's almost as if he doesn't believe what he's seeing is real. That's what it made me think of, at least.
Yeah.
And then to follow up into that, this is the moment where Percy realizes that his mother vanishing wasn't just a nightmare. The way that this is written in the book, whether using a Kindle or whatnot, because I've compared, it does it in both. Rick spaces it so it's its own paragraph. It makes it, it hadn't been a nightmare, and it's its own little paragraph, and then it makes you take an entire downward movement down. And to me, it's supposed to mimic that panic drop of, like, oh my gosh, this was actually real. She's actually gone. This is what's happening. My best friend is a goat.
Yeah, the thing about that is, like, that's great when, like, authors do things like that.
Yes.
And they add in, like, an actual visual cue.
Mm-hmm.
And with plain old, with a plain old Grover is how Percy first sees Grover. So it's, he didn't realize that it's, like, Goat Boy. It's that, well, that's also that, like, false hope.
Yeah.
Of it being all, like, a weird nightmare. And when I was reading this particular section, like, you know how you were saying, it causes, like, that little stomach drop thing.
Mm-hmm.
When I was reading it, because recording this podcast has made me look a lot closer and feel a lot closer and connected to the story. I've been getting, like, so much more emotional. I was absolutely devastated reading this. I was, like, tearing up.
She was, like, messaging me.
It was, like, it's incredible and incredibly upsetting because it's so good to feel so connected to a book like this.
Oh, yeah.
And it's making me read it in a whole new light as well because I'm drilling down into things and what's going on in the chapter. But, yeah, the attachment that you get to the characters is kind of heartbreaking because you're feeling all of their emotions. And it's heartbreaking.
It is. Especially because, I mean, we're both adults. Mm. And knowing that, like, obviously, no, we didn't live these specific moments, but I'm sure you and I can both relate to a moment like this where we felt similar things, or we, you know, were very angry with the world because of a situation that happened and we just wanted things to be normal again. Yeah. We have these emotions that can relate to it as well.
Yeah, and when Grover handed Percy the horn as well, that was almost an actual confirmation of his worst fears being realized. It wasn't a horrible nightmare he was waking up from. It really happened. The defeat, I can feel it. I know how defeating it is when things are crushed and you realize things aren't a dream. So it's reality crashing down around him as he grabs a hold of that horn. And throughout the chapter, he's like holding on to that thing for dear life as well.
And into the next one as well.
It's almost like a comfort blanket in a way, but not in like a comforting way. It's like his, it's like a resilient
He feels
thing.
Like it's his attachment to life right now. I'm going
to
make a connection to a later point in the series. Haha, spoilers. So Percy eventually goes and seeks, I don't know, immortality isn't a good way to say it. But he takes a dip in the River Styx, and he talks about having an anchor to the earth. And he goes, it's the small of his back that he goes on, and that's his anchor to the earth. So to me, I feel like this is a very, very early showing of right now, this is Percy's anchor to the earth, is this horn, is what's keeping him from slipping into,
exactly
like, mental sanity.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm thinking about. Yeah, it's like it's his anchor.
Yeah.
It's what's driving him to have the will to survive right now.
Absolutely. I just want to backtrack a little bit. When Percy's describing what he's seeing, he specifically says that it smells like strawberries, and to me that is peak summer. So the fact that, like, that's a happy scent to me.
Like freshly picked strawberries right off the bush. Oh, so good.
Percy has all these beautiful things that are happening. There's this beautiful view. He can see that there are more satyrs, kids walking around in bright orange t-shirts. And his only response is, my mother was gone. The world should be black and cold. Nothing should be beautiful.
I really loved that sentence as well, like when I was reading it. That's such a good way to describe that initial shock of like, grief. Mm-hmm. From my first-hand experience, it's like how unfair it is that the world continues to be beautiful and other people be happy and life goes on when you are hurting so much. It's portrayed so simply and so beautifully in a really devastating way.
Yeah.
How dare it be a beautiful, serene summer afternoon? How dare the air smell so warm and fresh and like inviting?
Yeah.
Everything should be nothing, basically.
Yeah. I kept going back to this phrase a couple weeks ago because I had just lost someone really close to me. And I remember just being outside one day and I was so mad. It was beautiful out. It was like 90 degrees. The sun was shining. You know, there was a nice breeze, so it didn't feel like it was 90 degrees. And I just remember sitting and thinking to myself almost exactly this line over and over again. So this is such a real response to what happens.
And then he goes into like a super interesting headspace here as well. We're trying to figure out where he fits in the world, being an orphan. He doesn't want to go back to Smelly Gabe. He'll do anything to avoid that. He's orphaned all alone. The thing that got me here is he's conjuring up a scenario about lying about his age to get into the army. Like, Percy, you are 12 years old. Honey, nobody is going to fall for that.
No, nobody's going to fall for
that. Nobody's going to fall. You are 12 years old. You are a literal child. Nobody is going to believe that you're 17, 18, whatever it is, to get into the army.
I don't know if it ever says what year this supposedly takes place in. I'll have to look into that. But, like, even if this is within the last, you know, 10, 15 years, nope, nobody does that anymore. That was, like, World War One and Two stuff. I think it just shows, like, he's not thinking clearly. That point right there is just, like, he's not all there. He's just not there.
Yeah, like, he's trying to work out where he's fitting in the world. Like, buddy, you've got, like, a best friend here who's not going to let anything bad happen to you. Like,
mm-hmm.
you have people, my guy. You're not all alone. even though he's feeling all alone because his world was literally ripped away from him.
Yeah.
Earlier we mentioned about how Percy was being spoon-fed while he was passed out, basically, like pudding. One thing we haven't mentioned is when Percy came round to consciousness again, there was a tall drink on a table next to him. And it's been waiting for him, basically. Grover, like, prompts him to drink it. And when he does, he's surprised by the taste because it's not what he was expecting. Like, tall, cold glass of something next to you, you're expecting maybe like a lemonade or something like light and refreshing.
He thought it was going to be apple juice.
Yeah, he thought it was apple juice. It tastes like chocolate chip cookies, but not just any cookies. His mum's homemade blue chocolate chip cookies. How does blue taste, for a start?
I'm going to guess, and this is just a really weird statement because I know that that's rhetorical. There's always just, like, a taste of, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Syntheticness to it.
Yeah, but it's, like, homemade synthetic tasting cookies, like.
Yeah.
I just think I love that that's what he tastes when we find out more about what this is later, though. And I really like the way that this particular part is described in relation to the grief and pain that he's feeling. It says his grief didn't go away, but it was as though his mum was there with him, telling him it would all be okay. And I really like that analogy and how it talks about grief in general in this chapter, because grief can feel a lot like that. It doesn't really ever go away, but it stops hurting so much after a while, and you get to the point where you can look back on memories fondly and you don't feel the pain of the losses harshly anymore. And I think it's super interesting that he's going through this grief cycle in a very short space of time just so that he has the ability to function and take in everything else that's going on around him, really.
Yeah. After this, we are then introduced to Mr. D and Mr. Brunner. So Mr. Brunner is there, but he's introduced as Chiron, which Percy is excited to see another familiar face. But the way that Uncle Rick really loves describing nasty men, he does it so well. To the point of where I can physically, like, it's really hard for me to think of, like, images in my mind. I know for some people, like, that's really normal, but that's hard for me to do. But it's never hard to do when I'm reading his books. That's one of my reasons why I really love reading this series.
Yeah, he's very descriptive, right? Mm-hmm. I enjoy it, too. Sets the scene as well, not just describe the characters. Yeah. That's good.
He's described, and I'm reading this just straight from the book, "The man facing me was small but porky. He had a red nose, big watery eyes, and curly hair so black it was almost purple. He looked like those paintings of baby angels. What do you call them? Hubbubs? No, cherubs. That's it. He looked like a cherub who'd turned middle-aged in a trailer park. He wore a tiger pattern Hawaiian shirt, and he would have fit right in at one of Gabe's poker parties, except I got the feeling this guy could have outgambled even my stepfather." Which is amazing. I'm pretty sure that, yeah, tigers is one of his symbols.
Oh, like how the eagle is the symbol for Zeus.
Yeah. Mm. Tigers is one of his symbols, and it has to go along with the cult of Dionysus, which I will touch on a little bit later. But they are called the Bacchae, or Bacchic women. So I know a lot about that. That might be a bonus episode at some point.
Ooh.
Because
fun.
I got to do a production of the Bacchae a couple years back, and I was the leader of the Bacchae, so I spent a majority of the show interacting with our Dionysus, which it was so cool. Yes, so that is how Mr. D is described, which is just perfect. I can just picture it. I don't know why, but it kind of reminds me of just a very, very, very disheveled Danny DeVito.
Okay, yes. That's probably a little mean, though.
That's why I said a very, very, very disheveled.
That would be like a dream cast, sort of.
Speaking of casting, did you see who is playing Dionysus?
Wait, hang on. Yeah, it's, what's his face from, no, I know this. Isn't it the guy from Brooklyn Nine-Nine?
I'm pretty sure he's in Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Crazy dude.
Yes, I know him from The Good Place. That's the show that I saw him
Jason
in.
Jason Mantzoukas.
Yes, he's actually Greek, which is super cool.
I love this.
And I think he's going to be fantastic. Like, perfect casting.
One of the things I do really like about how Dionysus is described, though, is like, Percy kind of picks up on who he is without actually knowing who it is. Like, he just knows that this... He knows that this guy's been on the sauce, you know? Like,
Yes. I think he specifically says, I've been around Gabe enough to tell... right here. If there was one thing I learned from living with Gabe, it was how to tell when an adult has been hitting the happy juice. If Mr. D was a stranger to alcohol, I was a satyr.
Right? I love that so much. Because it's like, okay, you kind of pick up on who he is, but you also have no context for who he is just yet.
Right.
So, it's like, of course Dionysus smells and looks like they've been having alcohol forever, because they're the god of wine.
And when Percy meets them, they're at a table, and Mr. D says, well, are you going to sit down and play Pinochle? And to this day... Every single time I read this chapter, I'm like, I'm going to learn what Pinochle is. And then I say, never mind, that's too much work. So if you think I'm about to explain the rules of it right now, you are mistaken, because I still have no idea.
Oh, yeah, I legit don't know what this game is. So whenever I reread it, I substitute something like Go Fish. But like, see, when I heard it, like, Pinochle... I'm like, that's Thumb Wars. What are you talking about? That's not a card game.
Wait, what?
Like, Thumb Wars. It's like, P-knuckle, 1, 2, 3. Won't you have a P-knuckle war with me? That's like it's a Thumb War, the Thumb War song.
What? No. For us, it's 1, 2, 3, 4. I declare a Thumb War.
Really? I might be wrong. I might be remembering it wrong.
There's also, a good chance that there's just cultural differences, because we do live in different countries.
Yeah, we call it Pinochle here. Literally, hang on. I'm gonna look at the wiki for Thumb War.
Aww.
I'm gonna read it. A Thumb War, also called Thumb Wrestling, Pinochle, or a Pinochle War in New Zealand.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not joking. I'm pretty sure that's the rhyme that we would use. Anyway, I'm kidding.
Okay, spelled very differently.
Yeah, it is, but when
Pinochle.
I heard it for the first time, yeah.
That's so funny.
So I was like, what? Like, literally in my notes I had written, I'm like, when I read the chapter thing, I'm like, WTF is Pinochle? A card game? I legit looked it up. I had just read it and assumed it was Thumb Wars.
I was going to say, you're probably sitting there going, why does he think he needs to know how to play Thumb Wars?
Thumb Wars? Yeah! But then it's like, okay, and then they mentioned that there's, like, cards on the table. I was like, okay, I have no idea what this is.
That's wild. So let me just clarify. So for the Pinochle that Minnie's talking about, it's like P, like the vegetable, and knuckle, like your knuckles.
Yeah.
Like your hands, fingers, knuckles. That's so wild. Oh my gosh.
You're welcome.
I wish you could have seen how fast my jaw dropped.
I love that it specifically says Pinochle in New Zealand. Like, why is it just New Zealand that calls it that?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm looking at you. I'm concerned.
Yeah, the song isn't listed on the wiki, but that's fine. That's okay. You know I'm not lying. It's on the wiki.
Yeah, it's literally... Oh, goodness.
Anyway, so, yep, hi.
Following up after that, we finally get a real description of Annabeth. And she is described as having blonde, curly hair. It's, you know, I think it's described as shoulder length. And then tan skin with her orange shirt and shorts. And every single time I would read this description of Annabeth, I was like, it's me, minus the gray eyes, because I have blue eyes. And I was like, it's me.
Oh, I always love when, like, a blonde character is portrayed as being intelligent as well.
Yes!
That was something that I really didn't like in some of the books I read growing up, because, like, it's always that dumb blonde stereotype. I loved that I had a book that I could read where I wasn't, like, where I could, like, physically relate to a character that was, like, smart.
Yeah. Now that Percy's, you know, fully conscious, the only thing Annabeth cares about is making sure that he's aware that he drools when he sleeps. And this is, in my opinion, the most iconic line from the entire series, to the point of where it is even in the musical. We meet Annabeth, and the song ends with her going, "You drool when you sleep." And it's my favorite.
It's their first proper interaction.
Yeah.
Well. So, like, of course she's just going to be like, put him in his place.
Yes.
Like, don't try to impress me, sort of a thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, absolutely. I know you drool when you sleep. Like, don't even try.
So, while Percy is learning about the world that he's actually living in, there are gods, there are titans. He doesn't know it yet, but there are giants and all sorts of other creatures. And Percy stops and he's like, wait, no. These are myths. This is what I learned about in Mr. Brunner's class this past year. So there's no way that this is possible. And Dionysus claps back with, so would you like being called a myth? Say, you know, 1,000 years from now, they use the story of Percy Jackson to discuss how 12-year-old boys get over the death of their mother. And it was like, all right, Dionysus, I'm going to sit back down.
Oh, lays it on thick. Absolute savagery.
And I'm not going to lie, ever since I read this story, I hate saying, like, Greek myths or things like that. I always say stories or lessons because I just never know. I never know. And you know what? I don't want to be called a myth one day. They're stories and lessons.
Stories and lessons. Got it. Yeah, with this conversation, like, when they're talking about, like, the heart of the West and the cultural influence that, like, the gods have on America because they move to wherever the heart of the West is,
mm-hmm.
It confirms what we were discussing in the dream sequence chapter about Zeus's symbol being the eagle. So it takes us back to that dream sequence. So I don't think Percy has yet pieced together that that's what that is. But it gives us, as a reader, a really, like, big clue into what's going on.
Yeah, definitely. After reading this chapter, I actually paid attention a little bit more of the architecture of the buildings just in my little city. And let me tell you, there is so much, like, white columns present. And, like, typically what you would think of with the Greek, that it absolutely baffles me if you sit and, like, actually look for a little bit. So I thought that was really cool, and I wanted to mention that because it is very, very much still alive. So Dionysus is my absolute favorite god, and there's many reasons for it. It's not all Percy Jackson related, but this sequence where Percy is starting to figure out that, okay, this guy must be something important because he got upset with me when I said that they were a myth. And I'm just going to read it straight from the book because nobody says it better than our good friend, Rick Riordan. Mr. D sounded about 6 years old, like a pouting kid. And I stammered, "Your father is..." "Demortalis, Chiron," Mr. D said. "I thought you taught this boy the basics. My father is Zeus, of course." I ran through D names from Greek mythology. Wine, the skin of a tiger, the satyrs that all seemed to work here, the way Grover cringed as if Mr. D were his master. "You're Dionysus," I said, "the god of wine." Mr. D rolled his eyes. "What do they say these days, Grover? Do the children say, well, duh?" Yes, Mr. D. "Then well, duh, Percy Jackson. Did you think I was Aphrodite, perhaps? You're a god." "Yes, child. A god. You." He turned to look at me straight on, and I saw a kind of purplish fire in his eyes, a hint that this whiny, plump little man was only showing me the tiniest bit of his true nature. I saw visions of grapevines choking unbelievers to death, drunken warriors insane with battle lust, sailors screaming as their hands turned to flippers, their faces elongating into dolphin snouts. I knew that if I pushed him, Mr. D would show me worse things. He would plant a disease in my brain that would leave me wearing a straitjacket and a rubber room for the rest of my life. "Would you like to test me, child?" he said quietly. Every single time I read that, I literally, like, even right now, I have goosebumps.
It's so good.
Dionysus is so overlooked in this series, and I feel like he's almost purely shown as, like, I don't want to say the comedic relief of Camp Half-Blood.
I was going to say comic relief.
But I feel like it's more to it than that.
Yeah. There's definitely more to it than that. But
I think
the way
he's the
that,
realistic
like,
look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's,
So, and that bit where he talks about he could implant a disease in my brain, there is, and as I pulled up the information about the tiger, it's called the Cult of Dionysus, the Bacchic Women. And towards the end of our chapter, Chiron asks, actually, I think I'm flip-flopping things right now.
Well, I think he asks Grover to, make sure that Cabin 11 is ready for Percy.
That's what it was. I couldn't remember who gave him the tour, if it was Chiron himself or if it was Annabeth. That's what I was struggling with. So...
Oh, I think, yeah, no, hang on. He sent Annabeth off to get Cabin 11 ready for Percy. And
yes.
Then, yeah.
That's where I was getting the mix-up from. So Annabeth goes to check on the cabin to make sure that it's all good. And Mr. Brenner then says, Cabin 11, Percy. Oh, this is Dionysus that says it. I'm sorry. Cabin 11, Percy Jackson, and mind your manners.
It's us!
Cabin 11!
Cabin 11!
Although, you know, Mr. D doesn't make it sound very friendly.
No, he doesn't. But I love... Look, this is the first mention of Cabin 11, and this is exactly why we chose the name.
Mm-hmm.
Cabin 11, it's where everybody has a home. At least until they're claimed.
Yeah.
But everyone's still welcome even after the fact kind of a thing. Cabin 11 is the mix-all. It's like everyone's welcome there all the time, which is why we chose it for our podcast name. Because, hey, everyone has a home here in Cabin 11.
Yes, it does.
Oh, I love it. We'll find out more about Cabin 11 in the next chapter, I think.
Yes, we get a lot of information.
Yeah, we'll get a lot more information. But this is the first little, hint of an introduction. Ah, I'm so pleased. We're here.
Yes, we are.
One other thing I did want to touch on right before, because this is, the end of the chapter now. Percy's heading off to Cabin 11. One thing I noticed is the weather during this chapter. Because there was a point when Percy was talking to Mr. D, and he said Zeus's name out loud, and thunder on a cloudless day happened, sort of a thing. And this happens twice in this chapter.
Yeah.
Once when Grover curses on the River Styx, when he was having a conversation with Percy, giving him the Minotaur horn. And then again when Percy had the audacity to call Zeus by name, and it's like, Percy, come on, my guy, pick up on that hint, you know? Like, how can you be saying they're myths when literally thunder is going to blast you out of the sky?
You literally just got lightning struck out of a car,
right?
48 hours ago, man. But sure, they're myths.
Sure, yeah, myths, definitely. Definitely not the god of the sky and heavens trying to blow you up. But yeah, no, it's that one other thing, you know, got to pay attention to the weather and what's happening there, because things that happen out of the ordinary, like, it's interesting that it's like a super calm summer sunny period at Cabin 11, at Camp Half-Blood anyway, because of all of the crazy weather that's been happening since Christmas. So it's like, this is a cloudless day, and now you're just getting a storm, like thunder shoot through, anyway.
Yeah,
I just wanted to mention the weather issue because it's been a recurring theme up to this point.
I'm glad you did, because I've honestly never picked up on that before, that it was a cloudless day. That's really cool. And then there is just one color thing that I want to mention before we jump into the comparing to Greek mythology. Percy kind of mentally relives his mother disappearing, and his mom is always described as disappearing in a flash of yellow light. So I looked up what yellow represents, and I specifically searched to see if, yellow light was different than just the color yellow, but there wasn't a whole ton of difference. So it represents joy, newness, freshness, and smarts. And I think this is really interesting because Sally does get a fresh start at the end of this book, and Percy is the one who gives her the tools to do so. So I thought that was just a really cool little color comparison as well.
I do love looking into color. I enjoy this. Yes, please tell me more about color theories.
So I just thought that was really interesting because we've already got the blue, which I know we had said Specifically, we were kind of aligning with the freedom part of it because Sally likes to be a little petty with the blue. So I thought the yellow would have been important too. For comparing our other Greek mythology stories today, I'm actually pulling from Argus, who is the security guard. So I discussed earlier that he is a 100-eyed giant, not to be confused with the 100-handed giant. Argus was appointed by Hera as the guardian of Io. She was a mortal woman, or it's a nymph, depending on the telling of the story, who Zeus was attempting to have an affair with. And he was basically asked to do this because he has 100 eyes, and he could sleep and not have all of his eyes closed at the same time. Argus unfortunately meets his demise from, I believe it's Apollo. So basically he just comes to an end by a god that Zeus asks to take care of him so that way he can, you know, go have this affair. But I think it's really interesting considering Argus is the security guard and keeps watch over Percy, especially during this time. And Argus is a reoccurring character throughout the series. And I didn't know a whole ton about him.
And he doesn't talk a whole lot.
No,
either.
Because there's a rumor that he has an eyeball on his tongue.
He doesn't want people to see it.
So as...
I've been looking at the roof of your mouth constantly. Sorry.
No, you're fine. That's hysterical. Oh my...
Like, no thank you.
Or like when you're eating and you're chewing.
No!
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Or like what if your like eyes like get really sore and tired and then to like just watch over people you just poke your tongue out.
That's so funny. Oh my sorry. Goodness.
We're getting way too sick.
So for Percy Jackson news, there's actually a couple different things. So this past week, Chris McCarroll and Kristen Stokes were at BroadwayCon to meet fans in New York City, which I thought was really cool. So there was some representation of the Lightning Thief musical, and that was on July 8th. So that has already happened, but I thought that that was really cool. I was scrolling through Instagram and that popped up, and I was like, oh, I'm so happy to see that the cast is still doing well. And still, you know, supporting the Lightning Thief. And then today, for me, July 12th, it is Annabeth Chase's birthday. So happy birthday to everyone's favorite wise girl.
Yes. Happy birthday, Annabeth. How old would Annabeth be? I guess we'd have to work out when the story
I'm going to look it up.
Sit, right? Yeah.
Because we know her birthday is the 12th. But did he ever say what year?
I guess it's fluid based on, like, I think at the end of the second series, she's 18.
Yeah.
So we'll just assume from the release date. 18 forever.
Like, yeah. Okay, so Blood of Olympus was released October 7th, 2014. So Annabeth turns 26 today.
Well.
You're welcome.
Approximately.
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 Approximately 26.
And before another series comes out, and she's still just 18.
Yes, so if I am absolutely wrong, sorry. But if the characters have aged since, you know, the last book, then she would be 26, as we don't have a year for her.
Mm. Yeah, other than release date. Anyway, yeah. Don't forget that you can find us at Kevin 11 Podcast, or one word. On Instagram, numbers as well. 11 is the numbers.
Yes.
I forgot to mention that earlier. And on Twitter at Cabin Percy. You can email us at cabin11podcast, numbers again, at gmail.com to share your Percy Jackson story or just in general connect with us.
Yeah. And Minnie also actually has made a Google form for that, which I'm going to attach the link to it in our description. Oh, and if you'd rather fill it out that way, super easy. She made it very nice and organized. So I'll make sure to put that in our description. And we hope you enjoyed your night in Capital 11. And of course, we look forward to having you visit us for the rest of the summer.